On Friday, October 18th, the Norris Group proudly presented its sixth annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts joined Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds for the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude's Children's Hospital. This event could not have been possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Property Radar and Sean O'Toole, Housing Wire, the Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association and President Bill Tan, Investors Workshops and Sean Watkins, Angel Bronzegeist and Sarah Benora, Invest Club for Women and Iris Veneration and Bobby Alexander, San Jose Real Estate Investors Association and Geraldine Barry, MVT Productions, Rhoda Construction, Wilson Investment Properties, and White House Catering. For event video and information, visit isurvivedrealestate.com.
This is kind of a fun segment because we'll probably get some interaction, which will be fun. And I'm here to protect either side from each other. No. I wanted to ask probably the first question. What most surprised you about the last year? I guess let's start with John. If you look back a year ago, what you thought was going to occur and what did occur, what was the biggest surprise for you?
Now, I'm going to throw out a compliment here at the same time, Bruce. You and I had a discussion in December when you told me home prices were going to go up 20% in the Inland Empire last year, and I said, no way. And you nailed it. So I would say that was probably my biggest surprise, and you got it right once again. So
I appreciate that. So price aggression was the surprise. Okay. Leslie, what about you?
I've never really heard it called price aggression before. It's like price appreciation.
When it goes 20% or more, it's aggression.
Aggression, okay. Well, I'm going to actually go back 2 years and say I think the lesson that I keep relearning over and over again is that markets really do change on a dime. And when you forecast forward, it's typically a gradual trend or you do kind of a scenario thing. But the big changes that happen are really hard to forecast. And when I look backwards at the market, in February of 2012, it changed. And I don't know exactly what happened, but when you look at the data starting in March, that's when the home price appreciation really started to take off. Inventory was below where it was a year ago. And to me, inventory is really the best leading indicator of what's going to happen in the housing, existing single-family housing market. But that's really what always surprises me, is just how quickly markets can change for really no apparent reason sometimes. I mean, it's like animal spirits.
Well, we'll probably talk on that because I'm a big believer, and that's a very important factor that's a little hard to quantify, but I'm susceptible. That's why I like charts. It prevents me from acting on how I feel a lot. Christopher, what about you? Probably nothing surprised you, right?
a couple things. To Leslie's point, inventories are the leading indicator, and what's amazing is how we manage to forget that constantly, because the cards were there for us to see. I mean, the inventory was dropping. You get below a certain level, you're going to have bidding wars. Simple as that, and that sort of drove the show. I wasn't surprised by the last year. I think the year before is, I think, when you really started to see it.
Yeah.
And that it really caught. You're right. It caught me by surprise when all of a sudden you started getting wind of these sort of bidding wars going on. That's not supposed to happen anymore.
Well, to be honest with you, one of the advantages we have is we're selling properties. So Greg, my oldest son, is buying 120 properties a year, and then gradually through 2012, we noticed the transition of. We put it in the MLS and have all the time in the world to fix it, and then somebody would eventually buy it. And we got to the fourth quarter of 2012, and we didn't have to fix anything. and we could sell it multiple offers, and even had a clause in the listing saying that the appraisal will no longer determine the sale price because you've aggressively bid up the property beyond its capacity to appraise, and people still bought it. So that's what forces you to go backwards and say, okay, what I thought mattered didn't happen, so what trumps that? And it was, there's nothing for sale.
Yeah, inventory is always got to watch that. That was a big surprise to me. And the other thing is maybe it's not so much of a surprise, but maybe more of a comment. You know, we're all celebrating the fact that prices are going up, but on the other hand, if you want to talk about California's economy overall, the single largest problem we have, housing's too expensive.
Housing's too expensive?
Way too expensive. And from you look at the state and who's leaving the state, and it's middle-income folks who can't afford a house here, and it's emptying things out, and we wonder why our factories can't get qualified workers, but we have so many people on the, you know, various sorts of social programs, and you can look right at those housing prices. So, you know, be careful what you wish for.
Okay. Now, okay, well, I got to think about that one. We just came off of 50% affordability, and that number had never been broached in California since 70s. So
it's never been broached in Texas in the other direction.
Yeah, but price aggression there is zero and always.
What's with this aggression?
Well, I'm an investor. I'd like something to go up. I'll change that if it makes you happy. But what's interesting about that, okay, and I'll just stop there for just a second. See, the rules don't make, they're not always the same. So you could go to Texas and say, okay, do you have migration of businesses? Yes. Do you have migration of people? Yes. You put that formula in California, you have price increases. In Texas, you've got nothing. So there's another 100 acres somebody can drive to.
If you look at the history of the last decade of population growth, now migration, what's amazing is we had a completely reverse pattern of flows. If you go back into the 90s when everything got bad, unemployment went up, people left the state because unemployment here was lousy, everyone in the nation was better,
right.
And you saw that out-migration.
Right.
This time around, the out-migration peaked in 2005 when our economy was on fire because home prices were so high.
No, because people sold their fortune and bought a Texas house free and clear.
Perhaps that too, whatever the case may be.
Okay.
The point is people were leaving at a very rapid pace. And then, of course, when prices dropped down or reversed, and people actually started coming back in despite our bad economy. So the pressures of housing costs in California are enormous. And you're going to see on the other side of the equation all sorts of new people pushing for regulations on affordable housing mandates and all sorts of new various social programs. You watch.
Bruce, maybe I can translate it a little bit. I think the affordability index is based on the median income household.
Right.
Last year's price appreciation was not driven by the median income household. It was driven by affluent households who live in California and foreigners. And that entry-level buyer, which is kind of the median income household or maybe a little bit below, was not present. And so we do a lot of work all over the country, and I know Deborah does too. We go to Texas and they talk about, why are you sending so many people here? I mean, seriously. You see all the California license plates. There is a big out-migration that is going on. And I think that, you know, $70,000, you can't afford a $400,000 home. You can't.
Okay. I'll think about that one. We'll come back to that. Now, Sean taught me something years ago, and it's always hard to hear something. You go, I really don't like that. But sometimes two charts can look like they work together just because, you know, like you have people migrating out in 2006, it's naturally because they can't afford it. But maybe they just cashed a $400,000 check and they can buy two Texas houses and that's why they left. I mean, it might not be because they couldn't afford it, it's because they made so much money.
Nobody wants to move to Texas.
Well, that's why they'll probably come back. Okay. Sean, the surprise for you for last year.
I'm still struggling with this inventory as a predictor because inventory bottomed at the end of 2005 when you and I were getting out of the market. So inventory as a predictor, I'm not so excited about. The big surprise for me this year was the whole taper, fumble, interest rate bump thing. I really didn't think we'd see any big move in interest rates until 2015.
And you feel like we've had a big move in interest rates?
Well, I mean, clearly they're still historically low, but I think it's
you and I know that personally, huh?
Yeah, but I mean, take that median income buyer in California. They can now afford, 10% less than they could, 60 days ago. And that, for that person, the median income price in 2000, you take the median income in household income in the state in 2000,
right.
You qualify them using the calculators over at Fannie Mae, and the median price is $250. That was our price. Go to the peak, 2007, using a pay option arm, take that median income household, they can now pay $550,000. Our median price, $550,000. Today, take that median income of $62,000, put it into their thing, $350,000 is what they can afford, and that's where we pegged the median at.
Buyers
have always bought
what lenders will lend
them. Lenders will lend them. That's how they buy houses. Well, the median price we show based on public records is lower. No, we're at 355.
Oh, okay. So you think it's over?
I don't think it's over. I think it all really comes down to what happens with lending.
Okay.
Right?
Do people, and I don't really know the answer to this completely, but a repeat buyer, don't they bring in a large percentage of their equity to their next purchase to where that loan just doesn't change? So that's part of the statistic that, we keep on moving that equity around.
Well, we're doing things right now in lending, and I'll turn this over to Deb, but, we've never done before. When we talk about, oh my gosh, we finally got rid of the pay option arm, it's such a terrible loan program. It's been around since the 70s. And it was a great loan program because if you got in trouble, you could make a lower payment. The difference between the 70s and what happened in 2005 at the peak is you used to get qualified based on the worst payment. Now they're qualifying you based on this, teaser rate, pay option arm payment. Nothing wrong with the loan product. It's only wrong with how we qualified people for it. Well, and yet we're going to throw it out the window. And we're doing this across the board with, looking at what happened historically, but without putting in any frame of reference. What happens next year, I think, is anybody's guess. We're doing all kinds of stuff. We have no idea what the implications of it are.
Well, the other difference is 20 years ago, you weren't doing cash-out refis like you did. And I think that's one of the things that people never talk about, and I'd love for Deb to weigh in. But I think the financial crisis would have been a third to a half less severe if you hadn't had this "my home is a piggy bank" thing going on for 3 or 4 years, because the subprime share in California, I think at the peak, was like 12% of the market. I mean, and again, it was all the CDOs and all the stuff going on all over in the financial markets. But just that whole phenomena of cashing out and taking money out of your home put so many people into harm's way when prices started to go down. And, you didn't have the same kind of domino effect in earlier cycles because people had a nest egg.
So.
No. I'm not buying that, Leslie. No, I'm going to agree with him. It was all pipes and credit standards. Look, you shouldn't be able to pull money out of your home. You can't pay it back. So it goes back to the idea that there was a lack of credit standards.
Just semantics. I'm just saying that there was a time when the equity in your home was not a flexible part of your financial portfolio, right? It was the money that was in your home. And what happened is it became easy to get at, and that's what people did.
Did that help the economy, though, too? As far as, mortgage equity was growing?
Not ours. Chinese economy. Yeah. No, because remember when all that was happening, we as a nation opened up to 6% of GDP trade deficit. I'm not being coy. I'm being very honest there. The fiscal value of that did not accrue to our nation.
It helped Bruce Norris's household accessing. Well, it really did. I mean, we could access. I didn't have to pay points for that. It was a cheap interest rate. I didn't have to pay a payment until I had a use for it. If I found a deal on the house, I could write a check, fix it up, sell it, pay the line back. I mean, how many guys in here, women, everybody, have done that? Oh, come on.
There's a difference between that, though, and buying an RV or a
car.
Yeah.
But I don't think I want the whole industry to restrict my access because somebody abuses it.
You could take money out of your home, and you can, as long as you can pay that money back, it's fine. You're right.
Right.
The problem was they were giving people home equity lines of credit that were larger than they had the ability to pay back.
Sure.
And the point is it ought to be priced differently in the market, and it's not.
Well, that
price,
was,
yeah.
That definitely, you know, we were doing a couple things. I agree with you originally.
Hey, you got someone to finally agree with you.
No, it's like the loan programs were morally innocent if used for the right buyer. And you're describing a very sophisticated buyer. If you think about, you know, the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Dodd-Frank, consumer protection, the ultimate change in dynamics is that Congress and the CFPB do not believe consumers will behave rationally in an irrational environment, whether it's affordability or price appreciation. And so consumers need to be protected, and we will certainly see whether, you know, it used to be as long as I disclosed properly, I would give a borrower a loan, and now there is obligations that the lending community will own to make sure. And I think it's also about layered risk. I mean, pay option arms are fine with maybe a down payment and a high credit score, and what, you know, but zero down, low credit scores, high back ratios, and a program that gives maybe too many options in the moment.
Or just the back ratio based on the teaser payment.
Yeah. There's a right way to underwrite all of this. So surprise. Probably would have said the price appreciation in the sand states, but I'll pick a different one. And I am generally surprised. There's been a couple of studies. The Research Institute for Housing in America, I believe Harvard did one, the Joint Center, and then I think Fannie Mae did one. The surveys that suggest that like 85-90% of America still wants to buy or still wants to own, that the fact that we have that appetite for homeownership after what we've been through is still a pleasant surprise.
So people have hit on a lot of themes that were a little bit of a surprise. I just wanted to add to the other conversation we've been having. There's an aspect of this, too. There was a change in the institutional structure of mortgage and originations. So if you go back to the S&L age, people held things in portfolio. That does make you behave a little differently. And you did have originate to sell, but people were originating FHA loans, and Ginnie got going. At some point in the 90s, you had commercial banks start to buy in the late 90s, subprime lenders, and behavior started to change. And by the time you got to the mid-2000s, you had the layering of risk that clearly is an important part of why loans failed. You know, if you subprime's an old product, if you're doing subprime with a 60 LTV in a state where you can foreclose in 6 months, yeah, the lender's not taking a lot of risk, right? If you're doing low doc for someone who made $1 million last year, but they own a business and the paperwork around that is not great because they're managing their tax situation, that's probably pretty, and they got a 50 LTV, that's one kind of loan. You're doing low doc for somebody who clearly has got a very middle-income job, and the broker's adding a zero or moving a decimal place on their income on the stated loan, that's a totally different type of product. So I just think it was a gradual thing. Cash out refis were part of it. The layering of risk were part of it. The ability to offload it, and lending institutions were focused on making quarterly earnings and fee income rather than holding the loan for a long time. There are a lot of different things that went into it.
I'm just curious, you know, all these loan programs we're talking about, you know, if you weren't in the industry or you didn't borrow money, which I remember there was a time in 2005, or maybe a little bit before, decided to pay off everything. And so all the nuttiness in the loan programs, I just didn't know what was happening because I didn't call up a lender and say, can I borrow money? And they would go, of course, you don't have to send in anything. I didn't know that was happening. I barely knew what a mortgage-backed security was. And then when all this hit the fan, you know, some of the reports that I wrote, I said, you know, prices are going to go down, but I didn't even know what a collateralized debt obligation was. It wasn't until later when I read that stuff, I said, you got to be kidding me. That's how we did it. And so I guess my question in a roundabout way was, are the buyers of that type of product ever going to show up again in sufficient quantity? I mean, or have we burned that bridge where that isn't coming back? That's partly what I'm concerned about going forward.
There's already some signs. I've heard some talk. I haven't seen many numbers, but the asset-backed, you know, collateralized, what do you want to call the damn things?
Debt obligations.
Debt obligations, yeah. They're coming back in the commercial space a little bit, but they're much more transparent. You know, look, there is a value to these things from a liquidity standpoint. You get that from an economist. If you have one big loan with one big building, you got no flexibility. You can't get rid of some of that debt when you need to, if you need cash for something. And, you know, so if you have these in tradable securities, it makes sense. You just, what the problem here was that there was a whole other second issue with the fact that nobody was watching anybody. The regulators were completely asleep. The rating agencies were a joke. And all those things need to be kind of brought back into some, if the forces are there that makes sure things are good and they do their job, there's no reason yet. Again, this shouldn't be part of the equation.
Okay. You think that's?
Yeah, I think you said the one word, transparency. I think investors will protect themselves in the future and there'll be standards for transparency so you know what you're buying.
Yeah.
And you know, I like a couple of things. One is if you look back at that period, complexity, opacity, those things, when not the friend of the investor or the borrower or half the people involved in the middle, you know, and I think you can look at the corporate market for an interesting analogy, right? In the 1980s, we had the junk bond boom, and then that crashed. Corporate America took on a huge amount of debt. Since then, corporate balance sheets are actually in great shape. Piles of cash, low debt levels. You do still have what are junk bonds. It's just, there's nothing like the volume there was. The covenants are better. It's not
actually,
being
they're getting
used
worse again. They're starting to slide the other way. So you might see some of those same old mistakes creep back into the system.
Right, and you have a cycle. Things happen, but you know, to me, what's interesting about this last cycle is you've seen in the 2000s, the households is where debt got out of hand. We had a massive run up. That sort of ended, except for student loans. That's the one area it's growing. And now we've shifted to our economy being dependent on a large increase in government debt.
So, I'm going to take a little issue with
the next part of the cycle.
If you look at the Federal Reserve's financial obligation ratio, which is an estimate of the percent of household income being used to service financial obligations, there wasn't a big problem with debt in the 2000s. It wasn't, because the financial obligation ratio, which was well over 12% in the 80s, got up to about 14%. You're talking a percentage point and a half higher. It's nothing because of the big decline in interest rates, which goes back to what has already been said. The problem in all those loan portfolios was not how much people were borrowing, but who was being able to borrow it. That's the primary problem, dead on, no doubt about it.
Right. I guess the only thing I'd add to that is that the monthly payment capacity, which is what that measures, low interest rates disguise how much debt there was. If you look at the amount of equity people had in their homes, and this goes to the cash out, refi, and debt consolidation, the equity that people had in their homes diminished dramatically during that time period.
When prices went down, not when prices are going up, it stayed steady when prices were going up.
And the amount of debt people loaded up on was just large amounts of debt.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Adrenaline Athletics, Claudia Buys Houses, Coldwell Banker Town and Country, Elite Auctions, Phoebe for Investors by Investors, Homevestors, In a Day Development, Inland Empire Investors Forum, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Investor Experts Inc., John Merrill Investments Inc., Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, Lavis Associates, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Northern San Diego Real Estate Investors Association, Orange County Real Estate Investors Association, Orange County Investment Club Phoebe, Personal Real Estate Magazine, Pilot Limo, Primary Residential Mortgage, Realty 411 Magazine, Real Wealth Network, REIExpo.com, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Southwest Riverside County Association of Realtors, Sonoka Corporation, Spinnaker Loans, UDirect IRA, Tony Alvarez, The Bottom Feeders, Tri-Emerald Financial Group and Westin South Coast Plaza. See isurvivedrealestate.com for video of the live event and more on our sponsors.